Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, as if there aren't enough animals and teens in our houses, Lorraine, a spider has taken up residence in the corner of the glass roof in my kitchen. And it's been there for quite a while now, but it's sort of, there's these little spotty deposits on the windowsill and then the odd sort of fly carcass wrapped up in sticky stuff. It sort of leaves us these awful little gifts. I don't like it.
Is it called Dave? We call all our spiders Dave. So that Mabel, my 10-year-old, doesn't get scared. And we say, oh, look, Dave's back. And she goes, oh my God, there's a spider. We said, it's just Dave. Dave is about 8 years old.
Oh, well, September is spider season. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. But I had a quite horrific spider experience in
September.
While I was inspecting my face in the mirror, as you do of a morning, rubbing in my HRT, quite close to the mirror, and a spider appeared in front of me. It had dingle-dangled itself down from the ceiling. And when I say a spider, I think I probably mean small rodent. It was enormous. I don't know how it was holding its own weight.
Oh, goodness.
For God's sake.
What did you do with it?
Well, I was very patient and calm. And I left the room to have a think about what to do with it. And then I went back in and bravely, because I'm not a fan of insects, but I'm not, you know, squealy about them, took the cord of the very strong spider web and then carried it through the house quietly, because you obviously can't make a noise, because if any child or teenager sees it, then all hell breaks loose. And it stayed on, this giant spider, until I got to the front door and dropped it outside. It's gone off now. I mean,
gone off out into the wilds. Well,
I did it
there
all
we are.
Without making any noise at all. Are you proud of me?
Secret, your superhero skill
bye,
has
Dave,
been revealed.
I said bye, Dave. That's the last we see of you.
Hello, welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
I'm Trish Halpin, and we're on a mission to help you make the most of your magnificent midlife. We'll be tackling everything from mind and body wellness to HRT and your sex drive. Lorraine and I are here to help you have a stylish second act and answer all your midlife questions on fashion, beauty, careers, relationships, family, and as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to your favourite podcast, Postcards from Midlife. Here we are again with more menopause myth-busting and inspiring tales of midlife adventures.
Yes, we do like an adventure, midlife adventure, and I've had one myself this week because
exciting.
I got to wear a sari for the very first time.
Gosh, how do you manoeuvre your perfect little derriere into that then?
Well, you get someone to do it for you, basically, because it's very very technical and very specific. So I was very honoured to be asked to be a judge at the Asian Women of Achievement Awards. And then they had the big fancy do, first big fancy do I've been to in obviously a very long time at the Hilton. And Pinky, who organises it, wanted me to wear one of her saris. And it was just amazing. So basically you get into this black, almost like calico long skirt that they tie up really tightly across your tummy. And then they weave the sari fabric around and fold it and tuck it in there and then pull it over and pin it up. And oh my God, it was quite amazing. But can't go to the loo in it.
Oh, well, that for you, that's an issue, isn't it?
Well, exactly. It's my sort of safety zone, isn't it? Going to the loo, popping in there for a few minutes. And so the lovely lady I was sitting next to at the dinner, who wasn't wearing a sari, said, oh, no, you absolutely can't go to the loo. She said, I had to do my whole wedding day. Couldn't go to the
gosh,
loo
wow.
even once. But there we are.
Oh, well done you, Trish.
Thank you.
Proud
that was
you.
My adventure. My adventure.
Good. Well, I'm a bit cheered up this week as well, because I've been reading through our emails and I was very greatly cheered by an email we got from a new listener, Nicola, in Kent. Lorraine and Trish. See that? Lorraine and Trish. Anyway, she says, a few weeks ago, I agreed to give a presentation to some of my colleagues to raise awareness of menopause and help make it less taboo. Whilst researching this, I came across your podcast and now I am absolutely hooked. Mm-hmm. I've learned so much about myself. My rage must have been menopause related, midlife in general, and with the help of your book, Lorraine, That's my book, Trish, Mum, What's Wrong With You?
Yes, your book, your book.
Things only the mothers of teenage girls know. I now know that my 18-year-old daughter buying secondhand trainers is perfectly normal, which was a relief. And as I walk my 10,000 steps a day, we've got to talk about that, 10,000 steps at some point.
The counting, Trish, counting everything.
Constant counting of female lives. I am now accompanied by an episode of Postcards from Midlife and learning to understand and embrace me. That's lovely.
Oh, well, that is really good to hear from Nicola in Kent. And she's got a good 60-something episodes to get through now, hasn't she? Because we've got a big back catalogue, which you can listen to whenever you want. Lots of amazing guests. And, helping women live their best lives, that was the reason we started this podcast. And it is joyous to hear from listeners. So you can email us, just like Nicola did, at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. You can tell us your midlife stories. And it's really great when we can share things from our community which help others, no matter how big or small. And we'd like to hear your nostalgia noodles too. Anything else helpful to share today, Lorraine?
I have actually got something specially for you, Trish. It's very helpful because according to the research, and God knows where they do this research, if I tell you this, you're going to live 13 years longer. What about that?
So I'm going to be 125, am I?
125. Well, you will outlive Margot, which will be a massive achievement. Anyway, if you live 13 years longer, 13 years more G&Ts, 13 years more telling Neil, your hot octopus, as we named him last week, you'll have to listen to last week's show to find out about that. 13 years of not Neil telling you at 7 a.m. or asking you at 7 a.m. what's for tea. So, but you want that, don't you? You want your extra 13 years.
Well, yes, that could be rather nice. But what do I have to do? What is it?
Have got to, every morning, stand on one leg with your eyes closed. Oh. Bear with me, listeners. I'm not making it up. Because if you do that, you're going to live longer. The proper surveys have proven this because apparently the ability to balance is a vital skill, which we've all lost because we sit down all the time. And when you get older, second biggest cause of death worldwide is falling over.
Yes.
All the complications arising.
It's the beginning of the end with a broken hip, isn't it?
Exactly. Somebody pushing you down the podcast studio.
Who might that be?
Anyway, according to Dr. Michael Mosley, the health guru, you need to be able to balance on one leg, any leg, either leg, 8 to 10 seconds with your eyes closed or 30 seconds or more with your eyes open. Mm-hmm. Now, weirdly, I can do both of those, but that's because I have size 8 feet. And I'm 5'2", so I think
the proportions.
Height to feet ratio situation.
Well,
can you do it?
Oh, well, I'm impressed with that because I can easily do the 30 seconds with the eyes open, no bother whatsoever. Eyes closed, I'm on the floor after about 3 seconds. But there's another one as well, which I'm going to see if you can do, which is
more
similar thing about strength and balance, where you've got to sit on the floor in a cross leg position, like you used to do at junior school, and you've got to get up without kneeling or putting your hands on the floor.
Silly.
So
can't
you've got to get up from
gymnast.
The cross leg position. I can do that. All those years of yoga pay off.
Is it truly that, can you do that?
I truly can do that. should we do a video of it? We can both do a video.
You can stand
on one leg with a blindfold and I'll get up from a sitting cross leg position. But yeah, that's a similar thing. It's all about the kind of stretch, ankle strength, bone strength, hip strength, and not falling over. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So what else is coming up in the show today?
Well, more usefulness. I am going to remind listeners that we are serious journalists with proper careers behind us. Talk about this ridiculousness. Anyway, we've got a really useful guest, super useful guest. She's probably the fittest GP in the land and Telly's favourite medic right now, Dr. Zoe Williams.
Oh, she is fabulous. And I can't wait to meet her because not only all of those reasons, she's a former gladiator. I mean, how impressive is that? And she's
I'd like
that on my CV. Mum at 41. What gladiator to add to all the other attributes?
Yeah.
Never too late. She's going to be guiding us through the best way to stay fit and healthy and the right weight for you in midlife.
Well, I need a bit of help with that because since I've gone back to being full-time veggie, I've discovered the joy of cheese.
Joy of cheese. That's your new book.
Oh my God, the joy of cheese. All cheeses that I hadn't eaten for a while. I'm trying to eat them all. 5 a day it is with me and cheese. But before we get to Dr. Zoe, we're going to be talking about other sorts of bodies, heavenly bodies. We realised we had never talked about horoscopes on the show. How could we have missed that after all this time? I mean, it's extraordinary. Now, I know they're not everyone's cup of tea, probably for the more whimsical element among you, but I do think Generation X women have a really nostalgic affection for astrology. The stars went out of fashion for a bit, but they have made a comeback. And given that it's autumn, time of new starts, or the new autumn equinox, we're going to have a jibber-jabber about them. And I found some very funny astro experts for us, Trish.
Oh, good. Not Mystic Meg, then. Moving on from Mystic Meg. Good.
Mystic Meg.
And we'll be also discussing the moon, because we've been talking about full moon madness, haven't we, after September's harvest moon this week. And you're off on a full moon swim, and I'm kind of quite moon-focused because of my sailing and just love a bit of the moon. So we're going to have a bit of a chat about that too.
Yes. So in the show, we've got practical and useful today, and also impractical and probably useless as well. So take that, woman's hour. You can't match us on any of those things.
Well, I don't think I've recovered from our sex toy last week, frankly. But let's get going.
Now, I'm going to preface this section of the show, our bit that we call jibber jabber, with a public service announcement. In case you didn't know, astrology is not a science, okay? I'm just putting that out there for everybody. So whatever you believe, that's up to you. Totally respect it. So this is just a light-hearted discussion for you over a cup of tea. I'm putting that in for Marion, I think. Trish, our biggest fan, who once called us, well, took the time to email us and call us ridiculous when we talked about missing our teenagers when they went away. Anyway, when I was the woman's editor of The Sun back in 1904, if there was one thing that was guaranteed to double circulation, or triple it indeed, it was a horoscope special. So back in those days, the astrologers, they were like rock stars. They commanded enormous salaries, and anything that said what your star sign says about you, your relationship, which we always put on the front of the paper, would sell thousands and thousands of copies. So I do myself remember being slightly addicted to my star signs as a young woman, and my friends were too. And I think a lot of single girls, particularly at the time, had that horoscope moment. I mean, I could barely decide what to put on my toast some days unless Russell Grant had advised me about it in the paper in the morning. Are you a star sign fan, Trish? I think you might be too sensible.
That's well, I am quite sensible, but I did love them because it's the kind of hope they give to you, isn't it? And the kind of, you know, I belong, this is me. But because working on magazines, we just ran these things all the time, didn't we? And January was always the kind of what's coming up in the year ahead. And when you worked on a magazine like I did, like More Magazine, which is all very sexy, they were obviously sex scopes. They weren't horoscopes. So it was all about telling you how many orgasms you were going to have in 1996 or whatever. But I have to say, I've got horoscope imposter syndrome because I'm a Gemini and Taurus cusp, which means I was born on the day.
Why have you complicated and overthought horoscopes? I mean, anyone could do it, it's you, isn't it?
But I think it's because I love the Gemini characteristics, but I'm not sure I ever fit the description because I'm supposed to be mercurial, easily bored, always on to the next thing. You can't keep up with me. And here we go. I'm extremely turned on by intelligence and a keen intellect. Would you say that describes
me? Amanda and I are looking at us. We're just agreeing with all of that. You think not. We think so.
Especially the bit that
she's nodding her head, Amanda. Well, Cancerians are supposed to be homebodies, but quite frankly, I'm not one of those. So
no. It's all bloody nonsense.
Anyway. You thought they were gone. Or maybe had lost their allure, but millennials, they're crazy for
them.
Oh,
they love them.
Crazy for them. So lots of papers have seen a massive increase in people reading them online. And The Cut, which is the New York Times star website, has had 150% increase in traffic to its astrology bit of the website, and so many others. Now, I discovered in the American version of InStyle magazine, they've just hired, because of this massive increase, a duo called the Astro Poets, who are widely acknowledged, not in scientific terms, but in the terms we like to get engaged in, as experts and the funniest and the most followed on. They're very funny on Twitter. So it's Dorothy Alasky and Alex Dimitrov. It just sounds so horoscopey, don't they? They've got their own unique style. They wrote Your Guide to the Zodiac. And I think you're going to like them, Trish, because they say things like, "Hello, Scorpio. It's Satan calling." Scorpio replies, "I'll do it. which basically sums up every Scorpio I've ever met, because my son's a Scorpio. Is it really ridiculous? Well, I will do it. Mm-hmm. Shall I read out what they've said about you for fall, as they call it in America?
And then I'm going to do yours. So you go first. Off you go.
Yes, this is the time of the soul. Fall. Now, listen. So you're Gemini, aren't you?
Yes.
Tiny. I have a problem with Gemini, you know, normally. Mabel's a Gemini. Tricky Gemini. Anyway, for fall, Gemini, your very close relationships, whether romantic or platonic, will test you this fall, can it be? They'll require patience you've been looking for and haven't been able to find for some time. Don't be hard on yourself, Trish. Remember that your eccentricity is one of your great strengths.
Yeah, not getting that. But they carry on.
Literally, I went ping. I thought, that is Trish. Something people admire about you, Trish. Allow yourself to be playful. To not overthink, bolted that out in the script, and stifle yourself. I mean, it's you, isn't it?
That is me. That bit's me.
Yes. Yeah. As the days get shorter, you'll feel a need to be a bit more reclusive and introspective. It'd be hard for you to be more reclusive and introspective. Remember that some answers take a long time to arrive. What about that, Trish?
That is quite true for me, because I like everything. If something needs to be done and sorted, I need it done now. I need to get it done, you know. Mm. So actually, you know, the old whirring round at 4 o'clock in the morning when you're trying to sort everything out that has to happen in the next 3 weeks, which doesn't actually have to happen right now. So I think that's quite helpful. I will take those words of wisdom. Shall we see what the astro poets have got to say for you? And the other, Cancerian, is that what the word? Listeners?
I always wanted to be a much more glamorous sign than Cancer.
Oh, what's a glamorous one?
Boring.
Gemini.
Leo. Glamorous.
Oh, Leo. Right. Okay. Well, listen up.
Go on.
Many close friends will need your nurturing ear this fall. I'm laughing at that idea.
I tell you what, people do not need my nurturing ear.
You just give them a piece of your
mind.
That's
not the kind of nurturing people want, I can tell you.
You know this role of caretaker well, and you mostly enjoy it. Remember to tend to your own peace of mind and well-being, even in the midst of being needed. The full moon in Aries, late October, will give you some energy to do that. Saying no is as powerful as saying yes. Being alone can be as restorative as being with others. Although you're a sign that gets their energy mainly from others, notice how much better you move through the world when you take some time for yourself.
Now, well, I do get my energy from others. Yeah. I can't bear to be on my own.
And I'm agreeing with the, you know, the midst of being needed, because you like being needed. You are needed. You've got four children, for goodness sake. They're at you all the time.
Yes, you're right, aren't they? Is it possible horoscopes are true? I don't think we can solve that on this podcast, because we know absolutely bugger all about anything. Yes. So least of all horoscopes. But I was reading about this psychology of astrology, because I do think there's something in, and I've worked with quite a lot of astrologers, and I think they're more, they're quite empathetic, and they're quite good about intuition, pretty spiritual as well, you know, possibly psychic, which I have more belief in psychic than I do astrology, I think. Astrology offers those in crisis, which I read in a big piece in The Atlantic, the comfort of a better future. So which means, sort of, if you're it's the hope situation again, isn't it? We're all under a little bit more stress now. That's probably why there's been an increase in people reading it. And it's astrology sort of tilts you in the direction of something you want to be going towards anyway. So you start to make decisions, something telling you, reinforcing, written down, means you start to make decisions based on going that way anyway. They're kind of a catalyst for change. So while they might not be scientific, I know there's a lot of thinking, and I don't want to upset any astrologers in our lighthearted chats about it, because it is about cycles. But there is a lot of thinking from a psychological point of view that is pulling the cycles together, recognizing patterns and putting ideas out there to people, and they move forward based on those ideas. So I think there is, it's quite a bit of worth in it, even though the studies can't really confirm
any sides. It's kind of almost like a coping device, isn't it? Because it's sort of advice delivered in a kind of, you know, mystical, spooky, fun, interesting way. You might not read a dry kind of self-help book, but you might read your horoscopes and get some good advice in there.
Well, people plugged into the moment and what's going on and the different types. You know, there's probably is 12 types of personality, and, you know, how they move together. And I have found that on the magazine teams I've edited, there's always been, without fail, a majority of Cancerians, which I don't know what that says. Cancer and Taurus.
You kept a record, did you?
I took a note.
Didn't look at their CVs, just found out what their star sign was.
Sometimes when I had to do lots and lots of people for job interviews and it would go on for days and my assistant would pop in to stop people going on and on, she knew that if I asked, and what is your star sign, it was time to stop the interview. You know, sometimes you just had to interview so many people. I never wanted to reject people just on this.
There's
CV.
Probably some legal reason why you can't ask that these days.
Probably.
But some HR contravention.
Get scientific about our slightly more woo-woo discussion. The moon, there's a bit more science around the cycles of the moon, because symbols of new beginnings, turning points, kind of rites of passage, and all the tidal forces. There is no science, however, to link one to the moon, the movement of the moon to one's mood. Although I do go properly bonkers when it's at a full
moon. Do you? Well, do you know where that comes from, don't you? It's because the lunar cycle is 29 days, and obviously a woman's menstrual cycle is supposed to be 28 days, but I think most women don't have a 28-day cycle. No. But that's that kind of connection between women and the moon and the cycles and all of that. That's where that comes from.
The only science, there is science and several surveys in the last 5 years saying that the cycle does affect your sleep. So when something affects your sleep, then it does affect your emotions and how you are. You get less sleep during a full moon time, according to the science.
Is that because if you've not got blackout curtains, it shines the light through the window?
No, that is one of the reasons. Yeah. It's a different kind of brightness. You see? So there's a bit you can find hope in all of it,
we
Trish.
Can.
Can't
meaning.
We?
Yes, we find meaning. Anyway. We're looking for meaning in these things. Can I do a very, very quick moon based mini culture club? Just really quickly.
You aren't going to sing, are you? Because that will
No, I'm not going to sit. Well, I might actually. Hang on, stand by. First of all, I'm going to tell you about a documentary Neil made me watch. He didn't make me watch it, but I felt like, because I always choose what we watch on TV, obviously. And he said, please, will you watch this new Apollo 11 documentary about moon landings? Can I just say, she's laughing away. I was. It's literally one of the best things I have ever seen in my life. It's all from this, like, it was made like a couple of years ago, and it's this 11,000 hours of uncatalogued audio and like original film footage. And it's all the crowds at Cape Canaveral, all in their 60s gears, watching the takeoff, all them like massive machines moving it into space. And then you've got obviously them all in space and landing on the moon. And there's no like narration, or it's not like done like a show. It's just like observational. And you sit there. I, honest to God, it is the wonders of science and the universe. I
could
really encourage everyone to watch that. And then my most romantic song ever, I think, is Harvest Moon by Neil Young.
Oh,
shall I sing it? No, don't.
No, you absolutely won't. Anyway, I think we have to move on to matters more scientific. There is a doctor in the house waiting for us.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This week's special guest is the powerhouse Dr. Zoe Williams, an NHS GP, TV broadcaster, rugby player, and former TV gladiator, no less. Her appearances on ITV's Good Morning and the BBC's Trust Me, I'm a Doctor have made her a household favourite and one of the country's most respected doctors. 41-year-old Zoe qualified in medicine in 2007, but decided to take a career swerve that would change her life forever, becoming Amazon, the gladiator on Sky's reboot of the hit 90s TV show. Since then, she has successfully combined work as a GP in London with appearances on shows such as The Real Full Monty, but her driving passion is championing physical activity with charity initiatives such as Fit for Life, an organisation she founded that delivers workshops to children to inspire, educate and motivate them to lead healthier lives. Growing up in Burnley in a single-parent family, Zoe herself struggled with severe asthma as a child, but was determined to have physical activity as a big part of her life, competing in athletics and rugby union. In May this year, she gave birth to her first child with partner Stuart McKay. So as well as sharing her expert fitness and well-being advice, we're intrigued about how she is planning to head into her midlife years as a first-time mum. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Zoe.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here with you.
Well, listen, congratulations on the birth arrival of little Lisbon. How is he doing? And probably how are you doing? Are you getting any sleep?
No, we're both great, actually. I can't believe he's almost 4 months. He'll be 4 months next week. And it really just feels like it's going so quickly now. I just want him to stay small. Oh. But loving it. It's amazing. It is the hardest job in the world, but that's what I expected. But yeah, it's great.
Well, it's very exciting to have someone who's got a new baby on the mm-hmm. podcast, isn't it, Trish? Because we've interviewed women who've got teenagers. So let's talk a little bit about the background to you becoming a mum for the first time. So you met your partner, Stuart, 20 months before you became pregnant, and you talked quite openly then, you're 41 now, about going solo, maybe having IVF or having your eggs frozen. Had you given yourself a cutoff time or an age or a date? How had that thinking progressed in your mind?
I was about to hit go on the going solo. I froze my eggs when I was 38.
Right.
You know, I've wanted to be a mum my whole life, and I always thought that I'd probably have my first child I always said 32. I thought 32, that would be the right age. But, you know, I've been in good relationships, but just not relationships where we ever got to the point where we were ready to think about having children. Mm. So as a single woman at 36, I started thinking about it. At 38, I froze my eggs. And then at 39, I'd made the decision that I was going to go it alone, mm. be a solo parent, use donor sperm, and was kind of just letting that bed in. And I was talking about it a lot to people and figuring out how I was going to make it work. And then I met Stuart randomly, like almost exactly 2 years ago.
In a bar in Lisbon.
In a bar in Lisbon.
Hence, you know, Lisbon. That,
not on a dating app, the good old-fashioned way.
In real life. Amazing.
I know.
So you're a mum now. We put a lot of pressure on ourselves as mothers because we want to get everything right. The world, society puts quite a lot of pressures on mums as well. Does it feel different? Do you feel different? And are you feeling pressure?
Yes. Mm. Yes. I think I've learned being a mum that I cope by reframing everything, and what is actually a new level of anxiety around even, you know, just having a shower. You can't relax in the shower like you used to. The baby might wake up, start crying at any moment, or venturing out of the house, using public transport. Everything comes with a new tinge of anxiety, which I like to just say it's more exciting. So there's a new added excitement to everything. But yeah, already, I think, God, I do think, what did I do before? Like, how did I spend 3 hours in the gym? What was I doing? So I think, yeah, time has become a much more precious commodity. It always was a precious commodity, but now I feel there's just this added layer of, I think it's one of the downsides to being, if I'm really honest, that is amazing and I'm full of love and we're in the love bubble and all of that, but you can't enjoy anything quite the way that you used to.
Mm-hmm. And support networks become really important, don't they? I mean, my mum died just before my twins were born, actually, and I found it really hard to cope with the kind of emotions of being overjoyed at having these babies, but utterly sad as well that she would get to meet them. She wouldn't get to meet them. And I mean, you're a motherless mother as well. How is that impacting you?
Yes, my mum died a few years ago. You know, she was very unwell towards the end. She had an alcohol addiction, and it really took its toll on her physical health and her mental health. I think, well, if she was still around, you know, she wouldn't really be able to help that much. But it's something I haven't still yet. I think haven't still allowed myself to think about it too much because I think I've accepted that my mum's died and that I don't have a mum anymore, but that my baby doesn't have a grandmother and that she's, you know, I think I mostly feel sad that she's missed out, that she hasn't got to meet him, especially because her death was preventable. You know, she could have still been here if it hadn't been for the addiction that she developed. So I think a large part of me feels really sad, more sad for her missing out than for me or my baby missing out. And also, if I'm really honest, there's a slight bit of relief as well, because it would have been very, very difficult to have negotiated and managed. You know, she would have wanted to be a part of his life and be a grandmother. And of course, I would have wanted him to have her. But that, figuring that out would have been really difficult. Yeah. We experienced it with my nephew. My nephew's 11 years old now. But she wanted to take a really active role as a grandmother in his life. But her illness meant she couldn't safely do that. And it was quite challenging at times.
So you, throughout your childhood, when you were dealing with your mum's addiction and her dependency and caring alongside your brother, and you also had severe asthma, and you went on to become a quite significant athlete as well. So you overcame the asthma and all the issues, and you trained as a GP, a little bit as a mature student. Where does that kind of drive come from? How do you find that energy to do all that?
I think it's part of my personality that if I'm ever told I can't do something, that motivates me to do it. And, you know, I come from quite humble beginnings. Mum was a single parent and her alcoholism didn't really kick in until she was about 14. So when we were young children, it wasn't an issue at that time. And actually, she was the one who, I was a very shy child. I had quite severe asthma, spent quite a lot of time in and out of hospital, wasn't very confident. But she actually was the one who always, whenever I would say, no, I can't, she would always say, yes, you can. And I think I've always heard that voice. I still hear that voice in my head today, because I still get nervous. I have huge imposter syndrome. Like whenever I sit on the sofa this morning, I think, this is it. They're going to find out I'm not actually very good at what I do. I can't do that. And I, you know, my mind says, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I still hear her saying, yes, you can. So she got me into sport. It was actually her and my paediatrician. My paediatrician said it's really important that Zoe gets involved in some form of sport and physical activity. It's important for her asthma, but also for her confidence and to help bring her out of her shell. So I started doing dancing classes when I was about 7 years old and just loved it. And we couldn't afford to continue after a couple of years, but I kind of found sport, physical activity. I found my competitiveness. And I think that's what then drew me towards any sporting activity that was made available to me. Made me competitive in the classroom as well. So I think that's what's driven me academically. Yeah, once I grew out of my asthma, I was luckily quite naturally gifted at most sports. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none. So I played at county level a number of sports, but never went any further than that until I got to university as a mature student, as you mentioned, at the age of 21, and found rugby. And that turned out to be the sport I then went on to play at county level and a premiership. So that sort of tided me over for what was to come later in life.
You do need that energy, because I had my last baby. I was nearly 44. I was a month and a bit off turning 44, and she's only sort of 10 now. And it was quite exhausting. But what I would say is, when I had Mabel and she was quite little, I went straight into what I now know, and what, you know, one of the reasons to set up the podcast was perimenopause. And just it hit me like a tsunami, the brain fog, the depression, the kind of enormous fluctuation of hormones, the kind of all the other related ailments, which I didn't really know what was going on at the time. So you're 41 now and you're a medic, so you know, I'm guessing you know what's coming, and you're very keen on the lifestyle changes that you could. If I'd known all of that, then I would have been, before I got HRT, I would have been able to life would have been nicer for all of us, basically. Yeah. Do you know what's coming? Are you talking about it to everyone around you?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that, even as a medic, I think that if there's one thing we're always in denial about, it's about getting older and the things that come inevitably with getting older. I mean, by definition, I am now in my midlife, but I don't see myself as that. I still think I'm young. The other day I was pushing the pram and somebody said to their child, oh, mind out for that lady. And I still thought, I'm not a lady, I'm a girl. But I think, you know, I guess having the knowledge, having the understanding, knowing what to look out for, and knowing the huge number of ways in which you can approach the perimenopausal and menopausal years, I think I have probably thought about the ways in which I will manage it. And my plan will be to throw everything at it, I think, starting with lifestyle, everything from nutrition to exercise and knowing what signs to look out for. But I, you know, certainly won't be somebody who is adverse to taking HRT if I think HRT is going to help me. I think I will take HRT, and I'm not even there yet. I'm hoping it won't happen for a little while yet, because if we're very, very, very lucky, I'd still like to have another baby. Mm-hmm.
Well, how exciting.
Yes, more babies, more lovely babies. But obviously you work as a GP as well as all your media work. So you must meet women who are maybe, we were like a lot of listeners, just not joining the dots. They're coming to see you in their mid-40s. They have got anything from migraines to mood disorder to low libido to joint ache, all of these different things. I mean, do you see women in that sort of situation, and are you able to help them join the dots? Because a lot of women do struggle with GPs helping them with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that is being talked about more and more outside of the medical profession. Perimenopause was something that, a word that nobody really even knew of a few years ago. I think it wasn't until your period stopped that people would think about treating you for menopause. Or, and I think, to be honest, I think that's echoed within the medical field as well. I think perimenopause is something that we weren't talking about that much several years ago either. So I would hope that things are changing, but I know from my friends, I know from what I hear about through the media work that I do, that a lot of women have very poor experience actually of getting the right help when it comes to managing perimenopause. I think it's so important that the media has started to portray it the way that it has. But also I feel like the media is, especially TV, way behind. I've been pitching an idea for some time now about what I call social infertility, which is what I was suffering from. As far as I was aware, biologically, I was able to have children, but I hadn't met the right partner. And women are choosing to take go down lots of different avenues to manage that, whether it's using donor sperm, whether it's co-parenting with a friend, whether it's using a professional service to find a co-parent, whether they're, you know, adoption. There are lots of different ways, and it's not talked about. So I've been pitching an idea for a while now. And what I actually got told at one point, I won't say who by or which channel, or that, you know, this is a really good idea and it's a really important topic, but the general public aren't ready to be interested and engaged in this. They're only just getting their head around the menopause. And I thought,
it's really depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is depressing. So I feel like where we're at the moment with menopause, perimenopause, with it being understood, and I think with women feeling more armed with the information, better informed, they're, you know, being good sources of information other than your GP, so that they will come into the GP and say, these are my expectations, which, you know, to anyone listening, you're very, very entitled to do. Well, and that should be welcomed by your GP.
I guess as a practicing GP, that's sort of what I want to ask you, because we know 2/3 of women are offered antidepressants instead of hormone replacement by their GPs. That's the most recent survey. And certainly I was offered antidepressants twice by 2 female GPs. And it's really difficult, and we get it so much on our private Facebook group, to go in and say, I've printed out the NICE guidelines and you're not supposed to offer me antidepressants. You just feel, if you feel you've got to get there anyway, got to get an appointment, and then you feel a bit right old ninny saying, I've already done this before you. And also I always felt seeing a young woman GP, I was kind of thinking, oh, I just don't think she'll understand what I'm going through. Thank God she's a woman, but I'm not sure she'll understand. But also I just felt bad about saying, you know what, actually I've done all the research and Googling myself. So this is, I'm a journalist and this is what I want. And even then it took me 3 goes. What is your advice to women who think they might be perimenopausal? Because that's the bit that's confusing GPs when they go in, particularly if they're facing an older male doctor who traditionally, as we've heard, may be reluctant to prescribe HRT.
It's really complicated. There are lots of different things, you know, like there was that study that has scared a lot of people into thinking that HRT
because we don't want to badmouth GPs all the time.
Let me break it down into what I think GPs are experts at. So GPs, we're meant to be experts at communication. That's our skill. So we're meant to be able to communicate effectively with our patients, but also that's about drawing information out of our patients. When you're in a consultation room with a GP, there are two experts in that room. The GP is the expert, supposedly the expert, in all things medical, and the patient is the expert in themselves. And actually, to get the right outcome, it takes both expertise from both people to come up with the right outcome.
Okay.
The other thing to mention is that as GPs, we know a tiny little bit about everything. Whereas, for example, you take a menopause specialist doctor, they know a hell of a lot about a very small amount. So we don't know everything about everything. And, you know, guidelines are updated all the time, and it is impossible to stay up to date with everything. So if you are somebody who is savvy enough, smart enough, brave enough, intelligent enough, you've done your research, absolutely don't feel afraid to take that in and say to your GP, this is my, I've done my research, especially if you're using, you know, the right types of resources such as NICE, such as NHS, Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. If you bring that into us, the way I would see it and the way I would hope especially most of my colleagues would see it, would be that we're two experts and we're sharing the workload.
Right.
Another thing I'll share is that when we learn communication skills, this isn't just GPs, all doctors, part of the framework that we're taught, we call it ICE. I is for ideas, C is for concerns, E is for expectations. So in that consultation, we should be trying to determine what are your ideas? What do you think's going on? What are your concerns? What are you worried about? And what are your expectations? And often, you know, with something like the symptoms of perimenopause, you know, they are vague symptoms. They could be 100 different things. If it's low mood, if it's, you know, fatigue, if it's brain fog, there are so many different causes. So part of our job is not just to look at the medical symptoms and figure it out what it is. Part of it is to find out, well, what do you think it is? Because you, even if you haven't done that research, you might have an inkling, and often the patient will have the answer. So to all of your listeners, my advice is the GP's job is to find out what you think it is, what your concerns are and what your expectations are. So don't be afraid to go in there and make their job easy for them by giving them that information.
That's brilliant.
That's really helpful. Now, even 4 months on from having little Lisbon, I mean, you're just the picture of glowing health. You really, really
are. Thank you. I feel it.
You look gorgeous. So we want all your advice on how to get even a fraction of that, especially in our sort of midlife years. So fitness, nutrition advice, what would you be social prescribing for? And explain social prescribing and then tell us what we need for our midlife years.
Okay. So a social prescription is when you kind of deliver a prescription or a treatment plan or a plan of action with a patient that doesn't require an actual drug prescription. So typically, to give an example, whereas in the past we might have prescribed medication for somebody who is suffering with, let's say, depression is quite a good example. Of course, antidepressants are one treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy is another treatment, but also we know that regular exercise, particularly if it's done in as part of a group, is as effective as antidepressants or as effective as CBT. So a social prescription would be helping the patient find what's available to them locally that they want to be involved in, that is a treatment essentially that isn't drugs. And of course you can give the drugs as well, and you can give all three and it works even better. So social prescriptions will be things like singing for Alzheimer's or singing for COPD, and they actually have a positive impact on the patient and on the disease process, but without giving drugs. So my social prescription for midlife, it's really difficult because it depends. Obviously everybody is different. I love exercise. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy the way it makes me feel afterwards. I actually would say I'm somebody who suffers with anxiety, and I suffer with chronic back pain that's well controlled with exercise. If I stop doing it, then I don't feel well. So, you know, I'm kind of like the physical activity GP. So I'm always going to lead with exercise. The great things about it are, it doesn't involve saying have less of something. So, you know, we all should be probably thinking about having less alcohol, don't smoke, don't eat this, that, and the other. Whereas with exercise, this is something you can do. It's something positive and you can do whatever works for you. I also think it has a positive impact on all of the other lifestyle factors. So if we're active, we're likely to sleep better. we're likely to actually choose to eat healthier foods. We're likely to be less stressed. It can have a positive impact on relationships. So it's kind of, for me, it's sort of the key lifestyle element. But some people really don't like it and don't enjoy it. So it's tricky. So my advice for anyone who isn't a gym bunny like me is try and build some physical activity, even if it's a small amount, into your normal everyday routine. So whether it's part of your commute to work, it's walking on the school run, simple things like making a habit of doing squats when you're boiling the kettle. And it's the little things that we do often that add up to a lot. And there's one stat I'll share with you because I always think it's really interesting. I'm kind of a bit anti-calorie counting. It does involve calories, but just to preempt with that, if you have an office job where you normally sit, if you stand for 3 hours a day, every day in the office, over the course of a year, the additional calories burnt equate to the same as running 10 marathons.
Oh my goodness.
What? Wow. Yes, it's really about it's the little things that we do often that can add up to be, to make
What about food then? What about nutrition and supplements and things like that? Because, you know, we've got bone health to consider in midlife, muscle decreases in midlife. What are we eating?
Generally, when it comes to nutrition, we tend to go along the path of the Mediterranean diet, which is lots of fruit and vegetables, oily fish, nuts, seeds, and trying to limit processed foods and sugary foods. You can sort of safely prescribe that for anybody, but particularly in midlife, particularly around the time of perimenopause, menopause, some things that are especially important are calcium, because we know that once estrogen levels drop, then bone density can start to drop as well. So ensuring they get a good source of calcium. If people are vegan, which is becoming more and more popular, then thinking about taking a calcium supplement is probably quite important, or looking for foods that have been fortified. Vitamin D is important for everybody, but especially as we reach midlife. And also there are some foods that contain plant estrogens, phytoestrogens, that are becoming quite popular. Linwoods are just launching a new product, a functional product that's designed for women in midlife. That's got flax seeds and chia seeds and something called lignans. They've added lignans. Lignans are a phytoestrogen. Now, the British Dietetic Association support that these can help with symptoms. They're not going to help like HRT. They've sort of got mild effects if you eat them regularly, but you know, they are completely natural and safe to take. So that's something that perhaps for women in midlife is an additional thing to consider. You know, trying to reduce processed foods, trying to reduce salt, trying to reduce sugar. And that's also important because sadly at this point in our lives, we are more likely to start to get things like heart disease, things like type 2 diabetes, and
about,
you know, weight
middles?
Gain can happen
yes,
as well.
Yes, I was just about to say the middles are muffin top middles.
Yeah.
That's annoying. What does it Dr. is, Williams and it's about, tell me about that?
When it comes to health, you know, if people are carrying additional weight on their arms and their legs, we call that subcutaneous fat. And as much as people might not like it, it's fine. It's not harmful. But if you're carrying additional fat in and around the organs, so visceral fat, it's we call it fat, but it is kind of an organ in its own right because it produces lots of chemicals. It produces lots of inflammatory chemicals. So if you're carrying fat, it's not the stuff under the skin that you can pinch around your belly button, on the other side of the muscle. So if you're getting bigger around the middle, that's the fat that is concerning. And actually, you know, that type of fat, you're more likely to accumulate it in midlife. It gets more difficult to get rid of after the menopause. But it is very sensitive to exercise, and particularly muscle strengthening exercise.
Right.
So the more lean muscle you have on your body, the more it helps you burn off the visceral fat, but also those harmful inflammatory chemicals that visceral fat creates. Lean muscle, when you activate it, creates something called myokines, and these are anti-inflammatory chemicals, so they can kind of dampen down any inflammatory effects. So I think for women in midlife, you know, pounding the pavement and running and all of that, if you can actually do something that's going to build you a bit of extra lean muscle, and it doesn't have to be a lot, that can really stand you in good stead from a health perspective.
Yeah, and you can do that with strength training at the same time, isn't it? Like bone strength and muscle strength, so the two together, really important. Yeah.
Yes. If you do exercise that gives you new muscles, even if it's not high impact exercise, it also helps with bone density as well.
Yes. How do you feel about your body now? You've just had a gorgeous little squidgy thing. What, I mean, it does, you, everyone sits down and reviews how they feel about their body after a baby. I mean, think about it, don't you?
I accept how my body is right now. I feel like I don't want it to look the way it does right now forever. But it does make me wonder, you know, having a second baby, I feel like I can probably get my body back to how I'd be happy with it eventually. I'm just giving myself a pass at the moment. But then I think if I have a second baby, I'm not sure I can, because my abdominis rectus muscles at the front of my tummy have split apart quite far. I think because I had quite strong muscles to begin with, quite thick muscle. Mm-hmm. Sometimes having well-developed muscle puts you at higher risk of separation. So they haven't yet come back together, which means I do still have a bit of a tummy bulge, which I don't like, but it's all about reframing everything, isn't it? It is what it is, and I can get my body back to how it was before. But I think until he's 6 months old, I'm just not thinking about it too much.
Yeah. And what are your kind of guilty pleasures then? Because whenever I see you, I mean, you're the, just energy comes out of the TV when I see
really?
You on this
one.
I think, oh my God, she's so, it's just, if I should do something now, I should just do some exercise now. Quick. Are you super, super healthy? You know, 5 pints of water every day. What's your kind of guilty pleasure? And give us a pass is what I'm saying to you.
Oh my gosh, so many guilty pleasures. Pretty much since the day I got pregnant, I have to have cake every day. Yeah, but that's just stopped the last mantra. 2 weeks because the baby's got a cow's milk protein allergy, so I'm looking for vegan cakes.
Vegan brownies.
Brands, so I definitely indulge in more alcohol than I probably should. Mm-hmm. I think that 14 unit is something that probably throughout my life, I definitely go outside of that quite frequently. I kind of live by the 80-20 rule.
Right.
So 80% of the time I eat mostly healthily and I'll be active and, you know, I try to drink water. So the way I manage that is if I'm at home, I try not to have too many unhealthy foods in the house because if they were there, I would eat them. But if I'm going out for a meal, which I do even less often than before, I'll have whatever I want. So if I want to have a steak and chips with extra chips and a pudding and 3 glasses of wine, because I'm out for a meal, I'll have whatever I want. But then I try and keep it healthy when I'm at home. That's the way I manage things.
We're both mothers of teenage daughters, and we'll probably have a lot of listeners who have got teenage daughters, and we're very aware that sport is something they shy away from or give up completely once they hit puberty. I mean, I've read one statistic that puts it just 9% of 13 to 15 year old girls do sport. I mean, it's shocking, but I know it's true because my daughter stopped. So you started this Fit for Life program. Tell us briefly about that and any tips that we can have to talk to our daughters without them storming off to their bedrooms in a huff.
Yeah, this all came about, I did a show called Gladiators.
Yes.
I was a gladiator back in 2009. And after that, I was asked to go into some schools and talk to children, awards events and that type of thing. And I always spoke to the girls. I would sort of address the girls because I knew that there was this discrepancy in that teenage girls in particular were less active. It comes from, for me, I'm so grateful that I was active and found sport and physical activity, because I do believe without it, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. It helped me academically, helped me overcome my shyness. You know, some of the best friends that I have today, my most reliable friends, are girls that I played sport with, made me competitive, made me believe in myself. And without any of those things, I wouldn't have become a doctor. I wouldn't be on TV. I wouldn't be talking to you right now. And when I see that statistic that only 9% of girls aged 13 to 15 are physically active enough for good health, so children need to do 60 minutes a day of activity, breaks my heart, because I think how many girls are missing out on opportunities because they don't have that, as well as it being important for their physical health and mental health, especially right now in the tough year that teenagers have just had. So I started Fit for Life, which we've just become registered as a charity, to try and really inspire and educate and motivate teenage girls to be active and find ways of being active, but also to give them a voice so that they could speak to their parents or their school, whatever it is they need to be active, they have the voice in order to make that happen. And what we found when we worked with teenage girls is often they didn't really want to play netball and hockey. Yeah. And they would say, in our gym hall, if you just put up on the big screen Joe Wicks doing 20-minute workouts, we'll do it. And then it's only 20 minutes. We've got time to get showered and do our hair and do the things that are important to us. They said, if you, you know, get a DJ in and put some lights on and we can just dance around, like they're saying, if it's actually the exercise that's important, it's not that we don't want to move our bodies. We don't necessarily want to wear these clothes, do this organized sport where actually for the first 20 minutes, we just listen to the teacher and then we get three goes and then we expect to get showered. So I think it's about really understanding that physical activity is about not just sport, not even just exercise, but anything that involves moving your body. Mm. And when we open it up like that and start to explore with girls, you know, what would they actually like to do? Because, you know, if a couple of friends come round and they put on some music and they dance in their bedroom for 20 minutes and get a bit of sweat on, that counts. Yeah, it's about trying to really sort of open up those conversations and allow them to do what they actually want to do.
It's a bit like midlife, really, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of the same thing. It's hard to get motivated because you don't want to go to the gym. You just don't want to do it, particularly if you have put on weight or your body shape's changed and you're a bit depressed. I found it's a similar thing with teenagers. Their whole body's changed. No one talks to them about sports bras. Their peer groups are quite judgmental of them as well, and they don't want to get undressed. And it's a sort of similar thing to, it's just self-consciousness, isn't it, getting out there.
There was a group of girls we were working with at a school out in Essex, in one of the sort of deprived areas. And this school, although it was in a really deprived area, they had the school was incredible and they had this amazing gym. And we said to the girls, you know, what about this gym? Like, we'd love to use the gym. Why don't you use it? Well, the boys are in there and they'll look at us. What would it take for you to use the gym? So, well, if after school, one day a week, it was girls only, we'd use it. Right. Mm-hmm. Hold that thought. In comes a PE teacher. Ask the PE teacher. The PE teacher said, which day? They're like, Wednesday. Done. From now on, that's it. Simple as that. And, you know, it's... just it's giving them a bit of a voice, I think, and allow, I think sometimes allowing them to think it's their idea as well.
Yeah. So finally, we can't let you go without asking about your time as Amazon the Gladiator. Was it the most exciting thing you've ever done? Probably the most scary thing you've ever done.
Yeah, I would say both, actually. Mm. It was one of those every day I was pinching myself thinking, is this actually happening? Because I loved Gladiators in the 90s, was a massive fan of the show. And I was a junior doctor at the time when Gladiators came back on our screens. Mm. And I ended up applying to be a contestant and was asked to be a gladiator. So I took a bit of a chunk out of medicine. I took a year out of medicine to go and do it. It was definitely the most exciting thing, but also the most terrifying thing I've ever done. And when you're a gladiator, you're not allowed to show that you're scared because, you know, especially my persona was quite, I was quite regal and Amazonian, they said. Mm-hmm. So the first event I ever did that was filmed, it was the pyramid. And it's one of those events where it's actually swayed in the gladiator's favour. So you're the expectation is that you'll win the game. And I'm quite scared of heights. Oh. So I'm stood at the top of this thing and the contestant's at the bottom and the contestant looked terrified and thought, that's all right for you. You're allowed to look terrified. And they're saying, Amazon, pose number two to camera number one. And I'm looking at camera number one and pulling my pose and just thinking, this is the most terrifying thing ever. My legs are shaking. But just what an incredible experience. Aww. And, you know, I've still got three of the girls and one of the guys off Gladiators are still my best friends today.
It was, and imagine just how impressed little Lisbon's going to be.
Amazon
goes off and sees that.
That would be embarrassed.
So cool. Well, listen, that is so brilliant of you to give us your time. And it is probably time now for you to get back to little Lisbon. But thank you so much for joining us and giving all your incredible advice and expertise. It's been so lovely talking to you.
Yeah, lovely to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Brilliant. Well, there was so much fantastic information from Dr. Zoe Williams. I think we should just reflect on what are you taking away from that, Lorraine?
Well, I think the really interesting thing, and it's she answered a question we get asked a lot that we've tried to answer a lot about how to talk to your GPs when your GP really isn't getting it, really doesn't understand the many, many symptoms of perimenopause. The way of her explaining it is you're the expert and the GP is an expert and the two of you are going to solve it and be curious about it. I think that's really brilliant. And being brave enough to take that nice NHS sheet in and say, you know, I don't need antidepressants. What I need is you to help me with my hormones. I think that was really useful. And the words she used were really great. So I'd really advise women to listen to that before they go to the doctor again.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's really good advice. Things I didn't know that Dr. Zoe told us, you know, that regular group exercise has proved to be as effective as antidepressants. I mean, how amazing is that? This whole idea of social prescribing, I was really, that kind of felt really positive and useful for me. And the sort of the little incremental benefits. Yes. 3 hours standing at your desk is equivalent to 10 marathons in a year. I mean, my goodness. And then
a badge for that.
You want a badge. And imagine if you did it on one
badge, a trophy, everything.
Imagine if you did it on 1 foot.
Yes. We're here. Nostalgia noodle. Take me back. Where have you been, Trish?
I've been back to the world of the brownies, not chocolate cake. I came across a very sweet little photo of me and my big sister, and she's wearing her brownie uniform, and she looks so cute in it. And back in those days, I don't really remember, it was a kind of very smart little dress with a leather belt, a yellow little tie with a brownie pin on it, and a bobble hat. And I just, what I remember about that is she was so upset because it had just changed from when brownies wore berets to bobble hats. I mean, who'd rather wear a bobble hat than a beret?
It's better.
But I was obviously desperate to get into this brownie uniform. Time came, obviously she got the new uniform because she'd grown out of hers, and I got the hand-me-downs. Always the way.
Trish.
Being the little sister. But it didn't matter because I love the brownies. I really love the brownies. Did you like brownies?
No, I had a disagreement with the brownies.
You were naughty, weren't you?
My mum decided it would escalate, so it was best if I didn't go back.
Are we allowed to know what it was?
We went, they sent us flower picking near the church hall. We went into a garden, picked some flowers in someone's garden. The lady waved out the window, so I mean there was no issue, but I think there'd been other leading up to this incident. And the brownie lady, what's her name,
Brown Owl,
I had to apologize, and I said I didn't think I'd done anything wrong because the lady waved, and I didn't want to apologize, and I was not of an opinion I did have to apologize, and I didn't apologize. And my mum said it's probably best not to go back because it would escalate further. And very wise of my mum, I feel.
So you never became a sixer, I'm imagining.
No, because I only went a few times, so I didn't do any badges.
Do you remember the brownie guide thing that you had to recite?
No, I wouldn't have liked doing that either.
You wouldn't have done. Didn't you have to put your fingers up, like your two fingers up like this? Yeah. Well, three fingers. Our producer is prompting us with three fingers, and you had to say, I promise that I will do my best to do my duty to God, to serve the Queen and help other people, and to keep the brownie guide law.
I don't like any institutional behaviour.
Anyway, enough of that. Brownies. Like, have you got something brownie?
Better,
you've got biscuit related, not cake related.
I've got
related.
A biscuit related noodle. Because this week we found out Mabel, who is 10, can't take sugar or nuts or anything like that to school. So she can't have anything with chocolate on in her packed lunch, which leads us, because we are such a biscuit family, it really narrows your biscuits down. I mean, there's barely any of them. So what I was looking for biscuits that she could take that might taste nice. And I found the malted milk ones.
Oh, yes.
Which take me all the way back to coming home from school. And my mum giving me a piece of malt loaf.
Yes, they made that on Bake Off this week.
Days, yes. And a malted milk biscuit, because they were kind of a good, healthy after-school snack. But
does Mabel like it? Does she like the malted
milk? No, she thinks it's a really boring biscuit. Oh. And when we looked at all the other biscuits that we could take from the 1980s, if we were going to take a retro biscuit, there was Breakaway. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Don't Take Away, My Breakaway. Mm-hmm. The Club, The Union.
Uniteds.
They were called Uniteds.
Yeah.
Choppy ones. And you could get a big box called a Family Circle, which is full of biscuits.
I think you could still get that.
Made me remember my gran, who came over once, my grandma, with like the biggest bin bag of biscuit bits, because a friend of hers was working at a biscuit factory and she couldn't get through all her broken biscuits. And did we want them?
And yes, you did.
Well, you sort of do, but they all taste of each other.
Oh, a bit crummy as well. Yeah, a bit sort of cupboardy.
So I think when I write my book about me,
Yes.
Which I know you're all looking forward
to. Yes, we want to hear more about you, Lorraine, because we haven't heard enough.
It's massive on the book about me. It will actually be My Life in Biscuits.
Your Life in Biscuits, like that.
Yeah.
Starting with a party ring or a custard cream?
Party rings we used to use for the kids' homework as rewards for them to sit down and do
homework. Very good.
Yeah,
very
that's good. A retro biscuit too.
Mm. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Postcards from Midlife. New episodes are available to listen to every Sunday on your podcast provider, and we would really appreciate it if you can make sure to download your episodes so they count on our listener numbers. And if you could rate and review us too, that would be very marvellous indeed.
And please tell your midlife friends about us, well, all your friends about us, because we want as many women as possible to join in the midlife conversation, which is what our private Facebook group is all about. Postcards from Midlife is the Facebook group. So if you're not a member, come over and join us. And you can also email us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com.
And you can use it to post any feedback on the topics we discuss, as well as suggestions for other things you'd like to hear talked about, or the celebrities and experts you'd love to hear us interview. So email us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com or pop a little message on the Instagram. Goodbye.
Bye.